Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is real and it is spectacular. The New York Mets haven't lost in a freaking week. The New York Mets sweep a homestand. The New York Mets sweep the Philadelphia Phillies. The New York Mets open up, what is it now, a five-game lead? Oh, my God, a five-game lead in the National League East by pulling one out of their derriere on a Wednesday afternoon, defeating the Philadelphia Phillies, having a 2-0 lead, blowing a 2-0 lead, going down 3-2, coming up big with a Pete Alonso clutch RBI double, and then winning it, from all people, part-time Starling Marte. The Mets defeat the Phillies. It is now a 7-game winning streak, and it is a perfect 7-for-7 on this homestand. The first time, and really the second time in Met history, but the first time they have completed a perfect homestand of 7 games or more since 2015, when they had that incredible 10-for-10 homestand back in April of 2015. And by the way, that season gave us a lot of ups and downs. They got off to the great start. They had a perfect homestand. By July, we thought they sucked. And then Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe were saviors. And then the Yoenis Cespedes trade, and they run away with the NL East, and blah, blah, blah. The rest is history. In 2025, we almost have to pinch ourselves. It is very, very early, and I want to make that clear. This division race is not over. The season is not over. But right now, as a Met fan, it is okay to feel very good. As a Met fan, it is okay to say, wow, okay, I'm enjoying myself every time I watch a Mets game. I'm enjoying myself every time I go to Citi Field. This has been an incredible start, and I think what is so magical about where the Mets are right now, sitting here with an 18-7 record, 25 games in, is that not everything is clicking. You know, we've talked a lot about the lack of clutch hitting. I think that changed for the most part in this Philadelphia series, but they haven't gotten much out of Juan Soto. We'll get to that as this podcast goes on. They are still missing two front-end starters, or at least one front-end starter, and another guy who we have no idea what to expect from in Frankie Montas, the front-end starter being Sean Manaea. You have an offense that's missing key pieces, though that will change over the weekend. More on that later with Jeff McNeil and Francisco Alvarez. And everything hasn't been perfect, and yet they're 18-7. Everything hasn't been perfect, yet they're finding ways to win in new creative ways on a nightly basis. So right now, 25 games in, completing a 3-game sweep of the Philadelphia Phillies, it is okay to ask yourself, is this real? Let me pinch myself. The only warning I'll give, and I'll give this warning throughout the year, and this is not being negative per se, because I said this a lot last year when the Mets were struggling, baseball can change on a dime. And when you are feeling on the top of the world and everything feels amazing and you never lose, you could go a week where it's the complete opposite. And that was the hope I had through last year's struggles. You know, as they were fiddling along through May and this season felt over, I would remind everybody who listened to the Rico back during those dark days, hey, baseball can change at any moment. So it would only be fair for me to remind you of that during the positive times. It can change at a moment's notice. Now let's get to this finale against the Phillies. We'll recap game three. We'll recap game two. Of course, we've got our Rico star of the series. We'll talk more about the roster decisions the Mets have to make and obviously the Edwin Diaz stuff. Let me start at the very end, because this was the kind of game, and I'm not sure everybody consumed this the same way, but this was the kind of game where I wanted to win, but I expected to lose. I was almost okay with losing. It was almost, you know what? They won a series against the Phillies. They are going to have a 6-1 homestand. It's okay. And that's not the right attitude to have, because even when Brett Beatty hit the bomb of a home run into the Coca-Cola corner, I still had that thought. When the Phillies came back and tied the game against David Peterson, I still had that thought. When I see Oscar Brazoban come into the sixth inning and Danny Young being asked to get big outs in the seventh inning, I had that thought. And even at the very end, after the Phillies scratched out a run, the Manfred run in the 10th inning, as the bottom of the 10th was starting down by a run, in a spot which you have to feel good about when you've got Soto and Alonso and Nimmo and Marte coming up, specifically Soto and Alonso. Despite Soto's struggles, I think you still have a confidence and you still want him coming to the plate. I still sat there as I was doing the show with Tiki thinking, I expect to lose. Not that I'm okay with it. I guess I am okay with it. But almost, it's baseball. You're not going to win every game. I fully watched this game expecting to lose. So you go to the bottom of the 10th inning. You've got the Manfred man on second. And Juan Soto taps out to the right side. And I know that most people listening were probably cursing out Juan Soto, saying, Jesus, I mean, I know you got a great arm and right, and you had that big outfield assist, but can you produce offensively? I was actually thinking, you know what? I would rather if him ripped the double up the alley, but at least if you're going to make out in that situation, at least it was productive. Because, and this is kind of the overarching discussion I had with some of my fellow Met fans before doing this, Rico. What do you care more about? The Mets winning or Juan Soto producing? And to me, it's a no-brainer. It's the Mets winning. I'd like Juan Soto to produce. I know that it's going to be needed if the Mets are going to continue winning. But in the bottom of the 10th inning, my thought is, I just want to win this freaking game. And advancing that runner to third base at least puts me in a spot where if Pete Alonso can hit the ball to the goddamn outfield, we have a tie game. Now, I didn't want to go to the 11th. I wanted to win the game right then and there because who knew who was going to come in to pitch? It was later revealed by Mendy. It was going to be Reed Garrett, who's pitched a lot lately. But what we saw with that Pete Alonso at-bat in the bottom of the 10th inning, down by a run, is how locked in this guy is. We are witnessing, and I think back to that incredible rookie season he had, and it was an unbelievable year. And I ask myself, are we seeing the best of Pete Alonso? Have we seen a Pete Alonso more locked in than this? And honestly, I'll give anyone, if they want to do the research, find me a 25-game stretch at any point in Pete's career where he has been as locked in as this. When you combine batting average, when you combine the quality of at-bat, when you combine getting on base, when you combine clutchness, when you combine driving runs in, I don't know if we've ever seen him more locked in. And the bottom of the 10th was the perfect example. He swings right over a Jordan Romano slider. It was a fat slider. It was right in the middle of the zone. He flat out missed it. He then gets a four-seam fastball at the top of the zone and again swings right through it. So he's behind in the count 0-2 in a situation in which hit the ball to the outfield. That's it. Obviously, I want to win the game. We all want to win the game. But at the least you're asking for is tie the game. That's it. Just tie the game up. Keep the pressure on the Phillies as well. And he gets an 0-2 slider that was low and it was away. And he hit the crap out of it up the gap in right center field. He is behind in the count 0-2. Not exactly an ideal spot to be. And he takes that low slider and he drives it to right center field. Have we ever seen a more locked in Pete Alonso when it comes into everything? And it's not just hitting for a high batting average, check. It's not just driving a lot of runs in, which he's done so far this season, check. It's not just an insane judge-like OPS, check. It's the quality of the at-bat. It's the fact that he tied the game in the bottom of the 10th inning behind in the count 0-2. He lays off pitches that are so close right there. He had a looking strikeout the other day in which Pete was shaking his head. I was shaking my head too, and I was laughing. I was like, you know what? Pete knows what I know, what Soto knows. That wasn't a strike. That's how locked in he is. His identification on pitches that are close, and we saw this in spring training for us losers that were paying attention back then. He is so insanely locked in. And after that, and he ties the game up, I'm certainly pumped up. But now I'm thinking, all right, we got to win this game right here and now. You've already lost Edwin Diaz to the hip, whatever it was called. I wrote it down. I'll get to that in a second. You've already short a bullpen. Who knows who's pitching the 11th? Again, it was revealed it was Reed Garrett. You got to go win this game now. You get the Brandon Nimmo walk, which, let's be honest, why are they walking Brandon Nimmo? You're getting that nuts about righty-righty. Oh, I'll go after Vientos. I'll go after Marte. I mean, Brandon Nimmo was 0-for-4 at that point. He's had some clutch hits this season, as we've identified, but you know, it's not like Brandon Nimmo is locked in right now. So sometimes I judge the opposing managerial decisions by how it makes me feel as the guy that's rooting for the other team. And when they flipped the four fingers to walk Nimmo, I was like, great. That was my reaction, which I guess shows you that Rob Thompson doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And after Vientos strikes out for the third time, here's Starling Marte. And what I love about this, what made this feel so good as Starling Marte came to the plate, not that I was expecting him to get the game-winning hit, was that when it's the usual suspects, which it's been a lot of lately, whether it's Francisco Lindor, who is so locked in, whether it's Alonso, who we just talked about, you love it, but it's expected. Starling Marte has not hit this season. He has not played consistently this season. And Marte has been open about the difficulties and the adjustment that he's made to being a part-time player. And here is Starling Marte's moment to be a hero. And he gets a slider, and he bloops it in the center field. And the image of Pete Alonso running around the bases and then the headlong dive in which he's down on the ground and he starts banging the ground with his hands. Oh, tremendous. That was beautiful to see. It was beautiful to see because I think Pete Alonso in so many ways, and I think this is why he's beloved by Met fans, even though some of you were ready to kick him to the curb numerous times last year and this season, and y'all know who you are. Pete Alonso exemplifies us. He's dorky. He's not very cool, but man, does he love the New York Mets. And when he's pumped, he celebrates it, and he lets you know about it. So the image of Pete being on the ground, banging his hands down on the sand as an electric City Field on a Wednesday afternoon where supposedly people are still working. But I don't see it, but that's okay. Maybe I'm jealous. Maybe I wish I was there with y'all, but I had fun working too. But that image of Pete banging the ground, tremendous. And then, and this is for good measure, because this is very, very important here on the Rico. Guess who was out at second base trying to rip the shirt off of Starling Marte? Hoff, I don't know if you know, so if you want to make a guess on it, you're more than welcome. I'll take you again. Second base, Marte, because he's just ran around first. He's at second base. He's celebrating. If you had to guess which Met was so raucously celebrating, they were basically trying to rip the shirt off of Starling Marte, who would you guess? The answer? Juan Soto. So for anyone who was concerned about his lack of celebrations from Friday night's walk-off against the Cardinals, I think he made you feel better because he was out there at second base having a damn good time. And I hope that Soto realized something that I'm not sure everyone will appreciate, but I did. He was a part of that 10th inning rally because Juan Soto hit a ground ball to second base. And I know,
$800 million for a ground ball.
It was a winning play. So I ain't complaining about it. Now, eventually, well, we want to see big numbers from him, of course. I'm talking about this moment. And the other thing Juan Soto did that was very winning in this game, despite not hitting a lot, what was it, a 1-for-4 day, was he made a difference defensively. He made a difference throwing a guy out at the plate. Not a perfect throw. Hayden Singer had to reach over a little bit and then apply the tag on Nick Castellanos. But then two other times we saw the Phillies not run on Juan Soto's arm. So the impact of Soto defensively was felt in this game. So I'll tell you right now. Now, there may be another day in which my tone is different. But on this day, I don't want to hear a damn thing about Juan Soto's struggles. Because all we want as Met fans is to win. That's all we want. And they didn't win despite Juan Soto. They didn't. They won with the help of Juan Soto. Because productive outs still matter, but more importantly, an arm in right field matters. Because it's a different effing game if those non-runs and the outfield assists turns into bad throws and runs being scored. Mets lose the game. So we can talk all we want about Soto's batting average and his OPS, and he's underperformed, and it looked like he was getting hot, and he got cooled off in the Philly series. That's fine. I'm not going to deny that he isn't hitting, but don't tell me he didn't make an impact on winning, because he did. He made a big impact on winning this finale against the Philadelphia Phillies. Now, he wasn't the only one, because you've got the defense of Francisco Lindor, who again has kind of moved away from those early errors from a few weeks ago. I thought we saw Gold Glove defense throughout this series. We also saw a bullpen bend, but not break. David Peterson pitched a rather effective game. Like, sometimes pitching lines can be deceiving. So 5 1/3 innings, 2 runs. Okay. I mean, it's not bad. I think you want your starter, especially in Peterson's case, especially in a case where your bullpen is short, to maybe get through the sixth inning. But I think Mendy was right with one out in the sixth to take David Peterson out. I think he had a right feel for his performance. But one positive I want to give David is if you go back to the second inning of this game, when Mark Vientos made the defensive miscue, David Peterson is set up with a bases loaded one out jam, and he made the big pitches to get out of it. And I think that's been the story of David Peterson over the last year. He may not dominate you, but he finds ways to get out of these tricky situations. And he was able to do that in this game. So, effective performance by David Peterson. Bases loaded, one out, second inning. And he gets Johan Rojas to fly out. He gets Trey Turner to ground out. He showed great poise making the big pitch when he needed to. You get a Brett Beatty bomb. And that was good to see. You also saw good defense from Brett Beatty, because on that Lindor backhand play that he made in the middle innings, it also included a very impressive Brett Beatty scoop. Now, one thing I've heard is, well, Beatty hit a home run. This was even asked in the postgame press conference to Mendy. Beatty hit a home run. That should make the decision more difficult when McNeil comes back. Let me make this clear. This isn't a prediction. This is just me giving my opinion, because I don't know what David Stearns is going to do. I don't know what Mendy's going to do. This is not a difficult decision. It's not. Jose Ozocar, who did have 2 hits in game 2 of this series, so respect to Ozocar. Jose Ozocar is gone. I'm not sending Brett Beatty down to the minor leagues. I'm not doing it. His bat has shown promise. He hit the two-run home run in game 3. I'm not sending him down. I also don't think you need to send him down. McNeil comes back. He plays a lot of second base. He could also play left field. We also saw him on Wednesday night play center field at AAA. So clearly, the Mets have put him out there, and they feel okay with him out there. So if you're bringing back an infielder slash outfielder, why would you need to option an infielder and not the outfielder? McNeil could do both anyway. So from a positional standpoint, I mentioned this a couple days ago, or a week ago, I guess, when Jose Siri first got hurt, that they didn't necessarily need to call up another outfielder. They've got a lot of outfielders. In fact, without McNeil even coming back, they got a lot of outfielders. Jesse Winker is an outfielder. Starling Marte, even though he doesn't play a lot, is an outfielder. We all know about Brandon Immo, who finally got a blow, finally got an off day the other day. So I don't think this is a tough decision. If the Mets option Brett Beatty down to the minor leagues, I will strongly disagree.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I agree with that. They can't option Luis Angel Acuña down, but if they did that, I would even strongly if you will, disagree with them on that. It's an easy choice. Jose Azokar came up here. He played reasonably well. Thank you for your time. I got good news. If the Mets win a championship, you will get a ring. Now back to game three. We saw Mendy, and this is another thing that's been beautiful through the first 25 games. There are teams who have back ends of the bullpen that they can trust, but when you get to the underbelly of one's bullpen, it's not as good. Carlos Mendoza right now is trusting everybody. And you saw it in a game like this where he had to. He goes to Oscar Brazoban with one on, one out in the sixth. And Brazoban very calmly gets a few flyouts and gets through the inning. Lets him get an out in the seventh inning. Here comes the lefties. Here comes Danny Young. And when Danny Young comes in to face Bryce Harper and to face Kyle Schwarber, I don't know how many people are confident. I'm certainly not. But Danny Young gets the job done. He strikes out Bryce Harper swinging. He strikes out Kyle Schwarber looking. Honestly, Danny Young, very underratedly, he'll get a vote or two, not first place votes, but third or fourth place votes for the latest Rico star of the series. Underrated. Underrated moment there when Danny Young comes in the seventh inning and he's striking out Bryce Harper and he's striking out Kyle Schwarber. Jose Buteau was very, very shaky. In his one inning of work, he walks a couple of guys, he gives up a hit, and quite frankly, got bailed out by Soto. That was the Juan Soto inning in the eighth inning when on the Max Kepler single in a right field, Soto makes a throw that's a little bit offline, but Hayden Senger does a great job fielding it, applying the tag on Nick Castellanos. I think the Phillies tried to challenge that. It was probably too late. It doesn't matter because he was out. But those are the little tiny itsy bitsy things. And Juan Soto was able to give you that arm that we saw. Remember opening day, Yankees Astros a year ago. That was the first impression or one of the first impressions that Yankee fans got from him. So not a great job by Buteau, but a great job by Soto bailing him out. As far as Diaz is concerned, I know that there will be some Met fans who are going to look at Diaz pitching a very clean and efficient ninth inning where he only threw 11 pitches and saying bringing him back is what led to these cramps or whatever they're calling it, hip cramps, side cramps. And as far as how serious the injury is concerned, here's the reality. We don't know. Mendy and Diaz said all the right things. Edwin says, I'm fine. Don't worry. I don't need any more imaging. We're not going to know. I don't even think tomorrow. We're going to know Friday. There are three steps to the Edwin Diaz injury. And we're not going to get those answers right now. Number one, does he go on the IL? That's a big one right out of the gate. If the Mets deem this injury serious, he goes on the IL. We'll see you later. 2 weeks, you're out. That's obviously not a good situation. Not what you want, as Joe Girardi used to say. Number two, okay, he's not on the IL. Is he available to pitch Friday? Now, we may not get that answer depending on how the game goes. Mets don't have a save situation. We may not know if he was available or not. Mendy's not going to announce it to the world, again, unless he's on the injured list. So step one, he's not on the IL. Okay, great. Step two, is he available to pitch Friday? Well, we may not know. We may not see him. And then step number three is if he does pitch and he is available, is he affected by this? Is this something we need to keep an eye on? So I was managing this along with Tiki because we were at a commercial break. Diaz pitches a clean ninth inning. And I said to Tiki right away, if they don't win it in the bottom of the ninth, Edwin Diaz coming back for a second inning is in play. And he says to me, well, has he pitched the second inning this year? He has not. But when you combine off day on Thursday with the fact that it's not like Diaz is pitching back-to-back, so it's not as if this is the second of a back-to-back, and then you combine that with only 11 pitches thrown, why not? Doesn't seem like a terrible idea. There is a perk and there is a kind of negative to Diaz pitching the Manfred Mann inning, however you want to call it. he is so bad at holding guys on that teams and players can take advantage of Diaz the way Bryce Harper did by stealing third base without an issue. And then a base hit that usually wouldn't score the run scores the run. So that is a negative. The positive is he's such a high strikeout guy in that situation where contact can score you a run. You want a guy who could strike guys out. But ultimately, I agreed with Carlos Mendoza. I thought this was a perfect scenario for him to pitch a second inning. I also combine it with the fact that they were short relievers. Like, who was pitching that 10th inning if it wasn't going to be Edwin Diaz? So I agreed with the move, and I do not think it's fair for anyone to say that's what led to the injury. Because aren't we all in favor in certain moments of allowing Edwin Diaz to pitch a second inning? I think that would have been one of the big criticisms Mendy would have faced right now on the Rico, or the next day, or the day after, if the Mets lost this game. If whoever came in struggled, it would have been, why isn't Diaz pitching a second inning? I know firsthand I would have said it. I would have turned this microphone on and said, hey, look, I know it's April, it's early in the season, but this was the scenario to do it because you had an off day the following day, because Diaz didn't throw a lot of pitches. So did that contribute to the hip thing? I don't know. And even if the answer is yes, no regrets. No regrets on, I think, making a sound baseball decision to allow him come back to pitch a second inning.
I'm confused by this injury, too, because did you hear the interview? I'm just getting a complete hoax of an interview here. They said that hit one leg was longer than the other.
Yes. Yes.
What?
So, yeah, no, I had the same reaction. And if there was ever a time to phone a friend, I would phone a friend, and that would be Tiki, because Tiki explained this on our show, because we mentioned it. We played the clip of a reporter and Diaz talking about one leg being taller than the other. And my reaction was, what? What does that mean? And Tiki was explaining that it's a common occurrence and it's very easy to fix. So, yeah, I can't go any further than it's normal. It's okay. Because Tiki told me, yeah, it happened to me all the time. So I can't add any other insight other than Tiki told me, don't worry. All right.
Okay.
Basically, it's not as weird as it sounds. Now, did that contribute to this issue? Maybe. Look, the reality is he okay? That's it. Is he okay? Is he going to be ready to go on Friday? Because I don't want to start thinking about a world without Edwin Diaz. I mentioned this at the during spring training here on the Rico, and I certainly said it on the air as well, that Edwin Diaz in a lot of ways was one of the most important Mets, because I think it's really difficult to replace that. And trust me, for anyone who rips Diaz or cites his ERA, who says, I don't trust them, I hope he opts out, I hope he's gone. Listen, you don't want to live in a world in which he's not on this roster. It changes everything about this bullpen. This bullpen's pitched very well. This bullpen did a great job in the Philly series outside of that ninth inning in game one where Max Kranich put a bunch of guys on base and Diaz gave up a home run. We have a graphic on the YouTube version of the Rico where it says Mets bullpen versus Phillies, 12 and a third innings, 8 hits, 5 runs, 4 earned. Yeah, basically all those runs was the ninth inning of Monday when they had a 5-0 lead and they gave up 4 runs. So the reality is, that's what the bullpen gave up. And so I think those numbers are even not as good as the reality. When it mattered, the bullpen gave up nothing. Nothing, I tell you. The only thing it gave up was when they had a 5-0 lead in the ninth inning and they made you sweat just a little bit, tiny little bit. Now, one other thing I want to address, because I do think this is interesting, was the argument and contention that the Phillies had that when Edwin Diaz caused the disengagement and then called the trainers out, that was his third disengagement of that at-bat, and so it should have been a balk. I believe, and before I even continue on this, it would not have made a difference. If they had called a balk, there would have been a runner on second. The next batter walked anyway. So I know it's flawed to assume the exact same thing would happen, but what else can we do? The idea, if this is a Philly fan or a Met hater saying, the Mets would have lost the game if they called the balk. Like, that's not based on any reality. Now, you want to give me an alternate reality where because there's a runner on second base, they give up a base hit? Okay, sure. We can play that game all day. But the reality is the next batter walked.
So it led to first and second. There would have been a runner on second and first anyway. Okay, got my point. As far as the call is concerned, I like using logic. I think logic's important. I think that rules are important as well, but I also think it's very important to use common sense. If a player is stepping off, yes, it's a disengagement, but you are literally calling out trainers and then leaving the game. Calling a balk would be stupid. It wouldn't be in the spirit of the rule. Now, I'll take this a step further. If Diaz did not come out of the game, so he disengages, Hefner, trainer, Mendy come out, and he's fine, I would then say, hey, you know what? To be fair, screw it. That should be a balk. I don't know if you were actually hurt. Did you disengage and realize, oh, crap, they're about to balk me. I'm hurt. Come on. So I get if there was no move to take the pitcher out, having an argument of, hey, come on, let's use logic here. That was a disengagement. But once the player is being removed for injury, I think it would have been foolish to call the balk. Now, Philly fans may disagree, but Philly fans got bigger issues than that. Let's be perfectly frank. If they're worried about a balk, non-balk call in the 10th inning, then they don't have their priorities straight because there are many other things, including their decrepit bullpen, including Jordan Romano, who absolutely sucks. I apologize. I suggested him for the Mets. Remember that during the offseason? For anyone that was checking in? And it could still work. Don't get me wrong. It is April, so this could still be a good move for the Phillies, but he has been terrible. He's had some horrible performances, and this one wasn't good. Honestly, he's ahead of Pete Alonso, 0-2. Gives up a game-tying hit. Gives up the hit to Starling Marte. But that's neither here nor there. This was an absolutely incredible victory to cap off what was a very fun game two of this series. Because in game two of this series, we saw a lot of similar things. The Phillies had opportunities. But Griffin Canning, over the first five innings, was absolutely marvelous at sliveling his way out of these opportunities. Go back to the first inning of this game. Phillies are set up with two on, two out. He gets Nick Castellanos to fly out. He gives up an RBI single to Johan Rojas in the second inning. But now the Phillies have the top of the order coming up, and they're all set up. They got first and third, or second and third. I think it was first and second. And what does Griffin Canning do in a 1-1 game? Does he give up the lead? No. He gets Bryson Stott out. He gets Trey Turner out. And the way he got Trey Turner out, let us not forget, because I know the loyal Rico listener thought about one damn thing on Trey Turner's ground out to Mark Vientos to end the second inning to keep the game tied. I'll refresh your memory, because maybe right now you're saying, I don't remember, Evan. Why were we thinking? What were we thinking of? Here's what you're thinking of. Pete Alonso made an absolutely insane backhand scoop from the throw by Mark Vientos to not only save a potential error, an error throw that is, but save that run or two from scoring. It's 1-1 bottom of the second instead of 2-1 or 3-1, and that's because of the scooping prowess of Pete Alonso. And here at the Rico, we've got scoopologists that study the scoopage. And I even heard my dear friend Big Mac, who is a loyal listener to the Rico Bronya. I heard Big Mac spend a few minutes on his overnight apologize for questioning the scoop tendencies of Pete Alonso. See, Pete Alonso has always been a great scooper. You're just noticing it now. And that was maybe one of his best. So we'll have to check our scoop charts from our loyal Rico listeners on this. But that was an unbelievable scoop. And I was concerned that inning because in that second inning, there was a play that really I thought was going to turn everything. He gives up the one-out double to JT Realmuto. And then Alec Bohm hits a comebacker. And what should be an easy second out goes off the glove of Canning and bounces away. And I thought that that infield hit, a play Canning should have made, had a chance to really be damaging. But it wasn't, because Griffin Canning finds ways to make the big pitches when he needs to. Fifth inning, his final inning in this game, he ended up throwing 84 pitches, but they were all very highly stressed. Two on, two out, Kyle Schwarber gets him out. Two on, two out, Nick Castellanos strikes him out. He had a 1-2-3 inning in the third, but in every other inning, the Phillies put guys on base. And they had a lot of guys in scoring position. So 84 pitches, five innings. This is why pitch counts to me are not the end-all be-all. It was absolutely the right time to get him out. Because after those five innings, he was doing the six to face 6-7-8 of the batting order. They all hit Griffin Canning pretty well in this game. They all had base hits against him. So I thought it was the right time to get him out. That's where we saw Waskar Brazoban, another guy who is a secretly under-the-radar star of the series candidate. He's not going to win it, but honorable mention for Waskar Brazoban, who comes in, wasn't easy, walked the guy, gave up a hit, got a big double play, got a big strikeout. But like everyone else on the Met pitching staff, got the job done. You had a great inning from A.J. Minter. You had a kind of shaky inning from Ryan Stanek. He got bailed out on that great Tyrone Taylor play where he threw out Kyle Schwarber napping a little bit off of first base. So the pitching from Canning to Brazoban, to Minter, to Stanek, to even Buteau, who finished the job in the ninth inning, all fantastic. And then you've got your offense. A lot of encouraging things from game two. First of all, Francisco Lindor is on base all the time. That continues to be an incredible trend, especially beginning games. A Mark Vientos clutch, two out, RBI double. A Francisco Lindor special when he drives in a run on a nine-pitch at-bat, flicking one in a right center field. And that was after the Azokar Acuna kind of mess up, if you will. I take you back to the second inning of game two. Azokar gets picked off. They have first and third. And as he's getting picked off, we're all thinking, all right, Acuna, you're off third. Try to score. And give the Phillies credit. They executed it perfectly. They executed the let's keep Azokar in a rundown. As soon as Acuna tries to score, nail him, which they did. So that was a base running blunder, mostly by Azokar, more so than Acuna. Because honestly, they ended up with a runner in scoring position. So Azokar was at least able to go to second. It sucks Acuna was thrown out. I mean, it sucks that you gave up an out, especially with Lindor and Soto coming up. But Lindor makes it okay with the RBI single. And then you've got your break open inning in the seventh inning. The RBI double by Pete Alonso. The clutch hit by Luis Torrens behind in the count 0-2 after Jesse Winker is intentionally walked ahead of him. And you get the offense to break out just enough. And it was frustrating because they got the two runs against Christopher Sanchez, and then Sanchez left with the forearm soreness. And now you're facing Joe Ross in the Philly bullpen, and for a while they couldn't hit it. And considering this is a Philly bullpen that has struggled all year, a little bit of frustrations. But they're able to break the game open when they need to in the seventh inning, and it's a nice, I don't want to say easy, because it's 2-1 in the seventh inning, but at least the last few innings were easy as they beat the Phillies 5-1. We recapped game one on a drive home edition. That is episode 468 if you want to listen back to that. But what a three-game sweep. From top to bottom, the pitching, the rotation, giving you five quality innings. I wish it was longer in the game, but Beckers can't be choosers. They're getting five quality innings out of their starters. They never give up home runs. Their bullpen bends but doesn't break. And even in games in which their offense frustrates you because they're missing the big hit, eventually they get the big hit. And eventually they break the game open. And there were a lot of guys that contributed over these three games. And look, we're going to do the formality of the Rico star of the series. But we all know who it is. We all know who ran away with it again. And of course, that guy is Francisco Lindor, who continues to get on base all the time, which he did in this series, and which he did in the St. Louis series. Francisco Lindor in this series was a combined 7-for-12 with two home runs, three RBIs, and got on base nine times in 14 plate appearances. Not too shabby. Not too shabby at all. Now, before we get to the formalities of the Rico star of the series and we analyze the returns of Jeff McNeil and Francisco Alvarez, Pete Hoffman, how you feeling on this fine day where the New York Mets sweep the Philadelphia Phillies, sweep the homestand, and are an ungodly 11 games above 500, baby?
seven wins in a row. I mean, there's just so many things to go off of here. You nailed it, though. Like, I mean, I was so content in saying, you know what? We can't win them all. We'll lose this game. It's not a problem. And then to see Pete Alonso, to see everyone keep on fighting back, it just – something about this team, man, I don't want to sit there and say they're going to win the whole freaking thing, but it is fun to watch. I'm not going to get excited. I'm not going to sit here and say they're winning the division. They're winning the – they're going to have the best record of baseball. I don't really care. I just love what I'm seeing. That's all that matters to me, is that every day it feels like somebody else is stepping up. They may not win them all, but damn, they're going to try to. I love that.
Very, very feisty team. That is for damn sure. I want to read this email. We have obviously a ton of emails. We may have to have a very special Rico mailbag soon so we can try to get to a lot of these emails. But Gandolfo wrote a great email that I think we have to consider. Now, a lot of people have ideas. Hey, you should do this on the Rico. Hey, you should do that on the Rico. And I always appreciate those ideas. Gandolfo has a really good idea about renaming the Rico Star of the Series. That is our name for the award we hand out. But he actually makes a pitch for a name change. Take a listen. Gandolfo writes, I love the podcast. I'm writing to let you know that I really like the idea of picking a Star of the Series, but I'd like to propose a different name for the award. I have to be honest, though. This name I'm thinking about is not my original idea. As a matter of fact, I'm stealing it from Mets lore. What do you think about paying homage to the immortal Jordani Valdespin by renaming the Star of the Series Award to the Man Right Now Award?
Yes.
I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yes.
The I'm the Man Right Now Award.
I am the Man Right Now.
Before closing, I'd like to give a shout out to my friend Cliff. No, not the scoopologist Cliff. Another one. We've been friends since we were 8 or 9 years old. We text almost daily, usually talking about Met baseball, even though he's now living in Rhode Island for years. Anyway, he's a great Mets and Jets fan, even though he's taken a temporary hiatus from the pain and suffering known as the Jets. So please give him a shout out. Let's go Mets, Gandolfo. Well, Cliff, I'll give you a shout out, but what do you mean you're getting a break from being a Jet fan? Like, yeah, listen, I mean, that's like, I'm taking a break from breathing. I mean, unfortunately, we live with this. I know Hoff's trying the same thing. Like, I'm not rooting for them anymore. Give me a break. We're stuck for life. It is what it is. With that said, I'm very open to the Rico Star of the Series becoming the I'm the Man Right Now Award, because that does live in Met lore.
By the way, I feel like Jordani is someone who is very much a fan of the Mets these days. I remember seeing him tweet over the off season, and something happened, and he was very excited about this team. And I even added him and said, "We need Jordani to maybe throw out a first pitch one of these days soon." And he replied with a thumbs up, and he seemed very into it. So maybe he should come on and present the first ever "I Am the Man Right Now" award.
I think he would love that. That's for sure. I do want to read this email from Dan. Only one time with this type of start have the Mets failed to make the playoffs. And this is his research from 1990. And I'll trust Dan. He's usually very good. Here are their best starts since 1990. And this goes in chronological order. 1999, they started 16-9. That year, they got to the NLCS, as we know, and lost to Atlanta. 2006, they started 17-8. They got to the NLCS and lost to the Cardinals that year. 2015, they started 16-9, got to the World Series, lost to Kansas City. 2016 started 16-9, got to the playoffs, lost to the Giants in the wild card game. And 2018, 16-9, that was the year where they started 11-1, the Mickey Callaway year, his first year as manager. And it was all downhill after that. I mean, they ended up being buried by May, if you go back to where that season went. So 16-9 wasn't very good, considering they started 11-1. They were 5-8 in their last 13 games. So 2018 is the caveat, because they were not a good team that year. And then 2022, they went 17-8. So the point Dan is making is, as we sit here at 18-7, this is the best start that they've had since prior to 1990. And most of those years ended with them being a playoff team, which is the bar. I mean, especially in the new world we live in where there are more playoff teams, I think that, yeah, damn right, they better be a playoff team. I think we'd all admit it'd be a freaking disaster. And I'm not just talking about their record right now. I think going into the season, our thought was they better be a freaking playoff team.
Yeah, well, when you sign the, you know, the biggest free agent in the offseason, make a contract that's like $765 million, and you have the second highest payroll in baseball, yeah, you better make the playoffs. Like, I'm sorry. Like, we went through last year where it's like, hey, you know, what are the New York Mets? What are they going to be? And they passed the smell test. They passed the we are actually a legitimate threat in Major League Baseball. And now you just have to be there every single year. Now it's the New York Yankee style baseball. Regular season's fun, but what are you going to do in the playoffs?
Well, let's worry about that when we're in the playoffs. I don't want to sit here in freaking April worrying about that. The other thing is, we talk about great starts. The 1986 Mets, the holy grail of Mets teams. Did I say 86 Mets? Well, maybe that was just the 86 Mets. They began their 25-game start at 20-5. So the Mets, not quite at the pace of 1986, which is fine, which is understandable. That's the holy grail of baseball teams. Let me get to the roster stuff. So Jeff McNeil is on his way back. He had a couple of more hits on Wednesday. So Friday night in Washington, he should be activated. I am fine with it, obviously. I'm excited about it. I think that it adds more depth to this roster. And hopefully McNeil can build off of the second half he had last year, where he was a productive player. I remember when McNeil first got hurt, we had this discussion, is he guaranteed a spot? I don't think he's guaranteed a spot. I think that Mendy's got to manage this where, who gives me the best chance to win? Look, Luis Angel Acuna brings value to this team that cannot be ignored, and he's played well with the opportunities he was given. Brett Beatty, he's hit a little bit. His defense has been a lot better at second base than we expected. But right now, the way I envision this is McNeil is here. He should play 5 out of 7 days at second base until proven otherwise. He goes out and he doesn't hit. Eventually, that may change. We saw that dynamic change with Acuna and Beatty pretty much right out of the gate, with Acuna outplaying Beatty for a while. And we absolutely need to see Acuna as a factor in center field. Has to happen. Now, you could do this a few ways. You can say, no, Acuna's going to play second and McNeil's going to play center, or McNeil's going to play left. Nimmo's going to be playing center. Look, it ends up the same in terms of who's playing. I would just rather see Acuna play center field. I am curious. We haven't seen it at the major league level. We saw it at the AAA level. I just want to see it happen. But the Mets with McNeil back will have more flexibility. They will. And maybe Brett Beatty gets at-bats at DH. Look, Jesse Winker had a good series, and that was nice to see. But I don't think Jesse Winker has to be guaranteed at-bats against every right-hand starter. Same thing with Marte. So if it is up to me, Ozokar, see you later, activate Jeff McNeil, and you play the hot hand, and you play the matchups, and I think if you're creative, and Mendy is, you can find ways to get everybody at bats. What we saw in the second game of this series against the Phillies was something that we hadn't seen much of this season, and I expected more of it, and that is Brandon Nimmo not playing. Brandon Nimmo got game two of this series off. That's when we ended up seeing Ozokar get the start in left field, bat ninth, actually end up with two base hits. But I think you can mix in more off days for Brandon Nimmo. I think there are days in which Tyrone Taylor plays. There are days in which he doesn't play. There may be a day in which you don't play Vientos. There's a day in which you DH a Beatty. And I think there are plenty of ways to have the at-bats go around for everybody. If it's McNeil here and Ozokar out and Beatty's still here. So I'll be disappointed if the news comes out that they're sending down Brett Beatty. The catching situation, this one's not that complicated either. Like, Torrens has been outstanding. He had the clutch two-run hit in game two of this series. And I think that's the thing about Torrens. His numbers don't jump out at you, but it feels like his base hits have been impactful. And they have. And we all know about his defense. That goes without saying. I think you got to play it by ear with Alvarez and Torrens. Alvarez should play upon his return, but he's a catcher. He's not going to play every day. I mean, all you got to do is look ahead at the next six games or the next seven games. I keep forgetting that the Nationals thing is a four-game series. They play Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then a wraparound on Monday. But let's walk through this, and we can see how the catching situation is not that complicated over those seven games. Friday night against the Nationals, play Alvarez. It's his return. He's been activated. Boom. And I'm not even looking at the matchups because I think the Nationals still have to sort out their rotation because they had a doubleheader last week. The only thing I know for sure is that Jake Irvin is all likelihood going to start the Friday night game. Irvin, who had some success against the Mets. The Mets have also hit him. It's been a mixed bag. So Friday night, Alvarez catches. Saturday, they play at 4:05. So sort of day game after night game. Luis Torrens catches. Okay, we just split it. On Sunday, you go back to Alvarez, an afternoon game. On Monday, maybe you go Alvarez again. Then you've got three games at City against the Diamondbacks with a day game after night game in the finale. So Torrens gets one of those games. Do the math. I just gave him 3 out of 7 or 2 out of 7. And again, see how each guy plays. See if Alvarez hits. See how his defense is. And it takes care of itself. Because right now, we're like, oh, Torrens, he's got to play. Yeah, I agree with you. Until Alvarez comes back and hits 450. And then all of a sudden, it's like Alvarez has to play. Manage it the right way. They will both get playing time. It's catcher. It's not a position in which one guy only plays. You need multiple catchers, and they're going to play a lot. So I look forward to seeing Alvarez. I look forward to hopefully this being his breakout year offensively and obviously watching how Mendy divvies out the playing time.
Well, also, here's the other thing. Like you said with Beatty, you know, there's no guarantee that Jesse Winker has to, you know, start against as a DH against right-handed batters. Why not give Francisco Alvarez, if he's hitting, yeah, if he's coming up and hitting, why not put him in over Marte? Marte's not crushing. I know he got the game-winning hit today, but he hasn't been crushing the ball by any means.
You're right. It's an option. I think the only negative with that is you lose flexibility when you've got your only other catcher as a DH. Like, I would rather carry a third catcher, which is not really fitting on this team. You know what? What I would say to that idea off is put a pin on it until Alvarez hits enough. Let him make this an issue. Go out and produce to a point in which we're like, man, I got to keep Alvarez a stick in the lineup. We're not there yet. He's got a lot to prove. So I would say that that opinion could be very valid come June. Upon his return, I don't feel that strongly about that. I would still want to get Marte's at-bats. I'd want to give Alvarez his rest and let him force his way into playing every single day.
I hear you on that. I mean, listen, let's just see him up here. I'd like to see him play a little bit regardless.
Let's see him play. Let's see him be healthy, and let's go from there. Hector writes, echoes of 86. Look at Philly, not St. Louis. There's been some buzz about the Mets sweeping the Cardinals, echoes of 86, the last time it happened, and a season that ended in a championship. And that's a four-game sweep. Remember, in 1986, I just know about it. In 1986, come late April, the Mets swept Whitey Herzog and the Cardinals in a four-game series in St. Louis, which famously, or at least according to the 86 VHS tape that I grew up watching, ask Sal about that too, Hoff, because I think he grew up watching the same damn thing. Whitey Herzog said the Mets are the team to beat. Like, he basically gave up the NL East in late April after a four-game sweep. So when we talk about sweeping the Cardinals, I think it's the four-game sweep that is very much connected. Anyhow, Hector goes on to write, the last time it happened, 86, it ended in a season that won a championship. The comparison, while nostalgic, lacks context. Yes, victories over St. Louis are satisfying, but in 1986, the Cardinals were divisional foes and reigning NL East champions from the prior year. The sweep carried weight. It was a power shift in progress. Today, if you're looking at a more relevant parallel, look to Philadelphia. The Phillies are in-division rivals and perennial postseason threats. A sweep against them isn't just a morale boost, it's a statement. It signals that this team is not only competitive, but potentially bound for something special. Let's go, Mets. I love comparisons, sometimes to a fault, because they don't really mean anything other than just us being nostalgia and it reminding us of things of the past. Like 2024, I said this a lot towards the tail end. It reminded me of 1999. Is very similar. What does that mean? Does that mean this year is going to be 2000? No, it's just as a Met fan, you experience a lot. You start to say, this reminded me of this, or this reminded me of that. I think that you're right. Sweeping the Phillies in late April, which is what the Mets did in 86, also late April. In fact, that series began on April 24th, and the Mets swept the Philadelphia Phillies on April 23rd, so it's almost to the date, is probably more of an accurate comparison. But also, where does this go? Will the Mets ever see second place again? I happen to think, unfortunately, we may. We probably will. I think the Phillies are really good despite their issues. I think the Braves are clearly figuring it out. I don't think the Mets are going to run away with the NL East. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they do. And I'm not sure in 1986 at 22-5 what I would have said. Maybe I would have said the same thing. Maybe I would have been like, ah, you know what? Cardinals are defending champions or defending National League champions. Ah, don't worry. They'll be back. I don't know what the hell I would have said, but that's the point. History will determine where this series sweep goes. If the Mets run away with the National League East in this beautiful, sexy hypothetical that I don't fully believe will happen, but let's just say it does, then I think you're right. We may look at this series against the Phillies and say, that's when the NL East ended. Or to quote a wise man, that's when the NL East was over. But that's only if they actually do it. Because if this is a race the way I think it will be, and the Mets drop in a second, then back to first, drop, and it's a real race, then we'll remember the series, but I don't think it will be as impactful as what that was in 1986, because we do have the ability on history to look back and know the Cardinals never made it close. The Mets won the series, and then it was just freaking over. So I do think that history is the proper context. All right, let's make this official. We haven't officially renamed the Rico Star of the series, but we are strongly considering taking the advice of that great emailer and calling it the I'm the Man Now Award. But so far, we've handed out the Rico Star of the series after every series. Quick recap. Edwin Diaz in the Houston series, Pete Alonso in the At Miami series, Max Kranich in the opening series against Toronto, Pete Alonso again for a second time, the home series against Miami, Kodai Senga against the A's, Pete Alonso in the series loss to the Twins, his third win, and Francisco Lindor, the four-game sweep against the St. Louis Cardinals. There are candidates, but it's clearly Francisco Lindor. Francisco Lindor was 7-for-12 in this series. He hit two home runs in game one, so two home runs in the series. He got on base in game one three times, two home runs and a walk. He got on base three more times in game two, 3-for-5 with an RBI, and he got on base three more times in game three, 2-for-4 with a walk, on base nine times in three games in 14 plate appearances, two home runs, three RBIs, and oh yeah, gold glove defense at shortstop. So there are other candidates, but Hoff, I assume we're making this universal that Francisco Lindor for the second straight week is your Rico star of the series.
No doubt. And I know that Francisco had a comment early in the week saying that he really misses his family. You know, they're not here right now. But it's funny, when he misses his family, he seems to go like at three hits every single game. So maybe he should be away from his family for a long time. I mean, it feel like I swear to God, if he I feel like he's on base at least three times a game. Every game he's away from his family.
Yeah, well, I don't want him to be away from his family, but whatever works, right?
He's getting better sleep. He's definitely getting better sleep without the kids.
I'll tell you this, when my family was away for a week, I got much better sleep. So you're right. Yeah. I think the sleep is clearly better. I'll give you a few honorable mentions. Danny Young and Waskar Brazoban out of the bullpen. I can't believe I'm saying it, but it's true. The pitching deserves honorable mention. Tylor Megill, Griffin Canning. Not as much David Peterson, but he was solid as well. And offensively, Pete Alonso always deserves honorable mention. 4-for-13, which isn't bad. He drove in two runs. He had the game-tying RBI double in the finale of this series with the Mets two outs away from losing, so certainly a very clutch hit. The other guy I give some honorable mention to is Jesse Winker. Jesse hit a home run in the opener of this series, came up as a pinch hitter in game two and drew a walk, and then went 1-for-3 in game three. So he was a combined 3-for-6 with a home run. So some honorable mentions, but it is Francisco Lindor. It is his second Rico star of the series. And he's the first guy to do it in back-to-back series. So really combine what he did against St. Louis and Philly on this homestand. He went a combined 14 for 30 with four home runs and six RBIs. Like that's a hell of a homestand for Francisco Lindor.
I think he's out of the April slump. You think you feel good about it? You think he's around? You think he's okay?
I think he has eliminated the April slump. I think it's gone and it's worth celebrating. This whole season has been worth celebrating, and you could celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser, light, bubbly, and easy to enjoy. Whether you're at Citi Field for these fun seven games or your favorite spot, ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name, a new tradition served chilled, imported from Japan, the official sake of Rico Brogna. Enjoy responsibly. I've got my bottle. Let's all cheers for a 7-for-7 homestand against the Cardinals and the Phillies. Cheers.
By the way, Max Kranick got to get some love too. I know that he gave up a lot of runs in that ninth inning, but like, I mean, he's a workhorse, dude. He really does. I mean, today he got the did he pitch did he pitch? Yeah, he pitched
Max Kranick. No, I think that's a great point by Kranick because he ate up two innings before the Mets blew the game open on Monday. And then, yes, he gave up a bunch of runs because he ran out of gas in the ninth inning. But we should not forget, I think I mentioned this on the drive home, Rico, that he pitched pretty damn good in a close game in the seventh and eighth inning on Monday before they broke it open. And then in the finale of this series, he comes into a jam, gets out of bases loaded, one out. He sort of contributed to it by giving up a walk and a hit. But nevertheless, he got out. He didn't give up any runs. So I agree. That's another solid honorable mention for Max Kranick. He has proven that no moment is too big for him. He has proven that.
Yeah. No, again, this bullpen has been something where I got to be honest. I know you're gonna hate to hear this, but they don't need Edwin Diaz. They don't, because they have so many other pitchers.
Don't say that.
Oh, but it's true.
It's not true. They don't need Edwin Diaz. You could sit here and tell me his ERA all day. That back end. What? Who's walk me through a world in which Diaz is no longer available. Everyone gets pushed up an inning.
That's fine.
It's not fine.
So far, this bullpen has been pretty much lights out. I mean, you talk about, like, I love Juan Gabriel, man. I love him. Buto, I know, has been a little shaky at times, but even he's still okay. The Kranick has been phenomenal. Now, they're going to go through their ups and downs. They're going to have a bad streak here and there. But I feel like you have more reliable arms in this bullpen than ever before. And here's the thing is, remember this. When Sean Manaea and or Frankie Montas come back, one of those, whether it's Tyler McGill, whether it's Griffin Canning, someone is moving to the bullpen.
We got a long way to go before we get there. A long effing way to go before we're talking about decisions on who. Let Sean Manaea and Frankie Montas make a freaking rehab start before I start to worry about who's going to the bullpen. The Met bullpen's been outstanding. It's not to shortchange them, but let's not forget that there are very few closers in baseball that are more trustworthy than Edwin Diaz. It's just reality. It's true. Name me five guys you trust more than Edwin Diaz, because you said Devin Williams last week. You don't actually think that anymore.
I still do. I still believe in him. I think he's having a rough April,
but he also missed half the season last year. So it's not reliability. It isn't just, hey, in the ninth inning, who makes you feel good or who's best at the top of the game. It's also being available. Look, Diaz had that missed season a few years ago. We all know why. But outside of that, he's mostly available. That's why I'm nervous about this hip thing, and I'm knocking on wood as I even talk about this.
Hey, listen, it's fine. They figured out his length. His length as well is good now. They're both the same size.
You always want to have good length. It's very, very important. A hell of a series. The Mets sweep the Philadelphia Phillies. They are 18-7, and now it's off to the nation's capital for three games against the Washington Nationals. Remember, after every series, we give you a Rico recap, which we have done. We will mix in some instant reactions as well. And I promise we're going to work in a mailbag, because we've gotten a lot of emails that unfortunately we haven't got to with so much Met content to talk about. So we'll whip out a very special Rico mailbag very, very soon. Remember to rate, download, subscribe to Rico Brogna, subscribe to it so you never miss an episode. Thank you very much. And Met fans, it's real. It's real. 18-7. Doesn't it feel good? Thank you for listening to Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.